Chapter 37. Irving. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 40 minutes, 58 seconds west. 24 April, 1848. There were 10 Eskimo standing there. 6 men of indeterminate age, 1 very old man with no teeth, 1 boy and 2 women. One woman was old, with a collapsed mouth and a face that was a mass of wrinkles, and one was very young. Perhaps, Irving thought, they are mother and daughter. The men were uniformly short. The top of the tallest man's head barely came up to the tall third lieutenant's chin. Two had their hoods back, showing wild thatches of black hair and unlined faces, but the other men stared at him from the depths of their hoods, some with their faces shrouded and surrounded by a luxuriant white fur that Irving believed might be from the Arctic fox. Other hood ruffs were darker and more bristly, and Irving guessed that the fur might be from wolverines. Every male, except the boy, carried a weapon, either a harpoon or short spear with a bone or stone point. But after Irving had approached and shown his empty hands, none of the spears were now raised or pointed at him. The Eskimo men, hunters, Irving assumed, stood easily, legs apart, hands on their weapons, with their sled being held back by the oldest man, who kept the boy close. There were 6 dogs harnessed to the sled, a vehicle much shorter and lighter than even the smallest folding sledges on Terra. The dogs barked and snarled, showing vicious canines, until the old man beat them into silence with a carved stick he carried. Even while trying to think of a way to communicate with these strange people, Irving continued to marvel at their dress. The men's parkas were shorter and darker than Lady Silence's, or her deceased male companions, but just as furry. Irving thought that the dark hair or fur might be from caribou or foxes, but the knee-length white trousers were definitely from the white bears. Some of the long, hairy boots seemed to be from caribou skins, but others were more supple and pliable. Sealskin? Or some sort of caribou hide turned inside out? The mittens were visibly sealskin and looked both warmer and more supple than Irving's own. The lieutenant had looked to the 6 younger men to see who was the leader, but it wasn't clear. Other than the old man and the boy, only one of the males stood out, and that was one of the older bare-headed men, who wore a complicated white caribou fur headband, a thin belt from which many odd things dangled, and some sort of pouch around his neck. It was not, however, a simple talisman, such as Lady Silence's white stone bear amulet. Silence, how I wish you were here, thought John Irving.
Greetings, he said.
He touched his chest with his mittened thumb.
Third Lieutenant John Irving of Her Majesty's ship Terror.
The men mumbled among themselves. He heard words that sounded like Kabluna and Kwavak and Miagortok, but had no clue whatsoever as to what they might mean. The older bare-headed man with the pouch and belt pointed at Irving and said,
Pifisak!
Some of the younger men shook their head at this. If it was a pejorative term, Irving hoped that the others were rejecting it.
John Irving, he said, touching his chest again.
Siksam, you are, said the man opposite him. Swingne!
Irving could only nod at this. He touched his chest again. Irving! He pointed toward the other man's chest in a questioning manner. The man stared at Irving from between the fringes of his hood. In desperation, the lieutenant pointed to the lead dog that was still barking and growling while being held back and beaten wildly by the old man next to the sled.
Dog! Said Irving. Dog!
The Eskimo man closest to Irving laughed.
Quimik!
He said clearly, also pointing to the dog.
Tunok!
The man shook his head and chuckled. Although he was freezing, Irving felt a warm glow. He'd gotten somewhere. The Eskimo word for the hairy dog they used was either Quimik or Tunok or both. He pointed at their sled.
Sled!
He stated firmly. The 10 Eskimo stared at him. The young woman was holding her mittens in front of her face. The old woman's jaw hung down, and Irving could see that she had precisely 1 tooth in her mouth.
Sled,
he said again. The 6 men in front looked at one another. Finally, Irving's interlocutor to this point said,
Kamatik?
Irving nodded happily, even though he had no idea if they had really begun communicating. For all he knew, the man had just asked him if he wanted to be harpooned. Nonetheless, the junior lieutenant could not stop grinning. Most of the Eskimo men, with the exception of the boy, the old man who was still beating the dog, and the bare-headed older man with the pouch and belt, were grinning back.
"Do you speak English by any chance?" asked Irving, realizing that he was a bit tardy with the question.
The Eskimo men stared and grinned and scowled and remained silent. Irving repeated his query in his schoolboy French and atrocious German. The Eskimo continued to smile and scowl and stare. Irving crouched and squatted, and the six men closest to him squatted. They did not sit on the freezing gravel, even if a larger rock or boulder was near. After so many months up here in the cold, Irving understood. He still wanted to know someone's name.
"Irving," he said, touching his chest again. He pointed at the closest man.
"Enoch,"
said the man, touching his chest. He tugged off his mitten with a flash of white teeth and held up his right hand. It was missing the two smaller fingers.
"Tikerquat,"
he grinned again.
"Pleased to make your acquaintance, Mr. Inuk," said Irving. "Or Mr. Tikerquat?"
"Very pleased to make your acquaintance."
He decided that any real communication would have to be through sign language and pointed back the way he had come toward the northwest.
"I have many friends,"
he said confidently, as if saying this would make him safer with these savage people.
"Two large ships. Two ships."
Most of the Eskimo looked the way Irving pointed. Mr. Inuk was frowning slightly.
"Nanuk,"
the man said softly, and then seemed to correct himself with a shake of his head.
"Tonarsuk."
The others looked away, or lowered their heads at this last word, almost, it seemed, as if in reverence or fear. But the lieutenant was sure that it was not at the thought of two ships or a group of white men. Irving licked his bleeding lips. Better to begin trading with these people than to engage in a long conversation. Moving slowly, so as not to startle any of them, he reached into his leather shoulder valise to see if there was any food or bauble he could give them as a gift. Nothing. He had eaten the only salted pork and old biscuit he'd brought for his day's rations. Something shiny and interesting, then? There were only his ragged sweaters, two stinking extra socks, and a disposable rag he had brought along for his al fresco privy purposes. At that moment, Irving bitterly regretted giving his prized oriental silk handkerchief to Lady Silence, wherever the wench was. She had slipped away from Terra Camp their second day there, and not been seen again since. He knew that these natives would have loved the red and green silk handkerchief. Then his cold fingers touched the curved brass of his telescope. Irving's heart leapt and then wrenched itself with pain. The telescope was perhaps his most prized possession, the last thing his uncle had given him before that good man had died suddenly of heart trouble. Smiling wanly at the waiting Eskimo, he slowly pulled the instrument from his bag. He could see the brown-faced men tightening their grips on their spears and harpoons. 10 minutes later, Irving had the entire family, or clan, or tribe of Eskimo, close around him like schoolchildren grouped around an especially beloved teacher. Everyone, even the suspicious, squinty-eyed older man with the headband, pouch, and belt, had taken a turn looking through the glass. Even the two females had their turn. Irving allowed Mr. Inuk Tikerquat, his new fellow ambassador, to hand the brass instrument to the giggling young woman and the old woman. The ancient man who had been holding down the sled came over for a look, and a shouted exclamation with the women chanting along,
"Ay-yay-yay-yanna, ye-hey-yay-yay-yay-yanne-ya-kwanna, ay-yay-yat-yanna."
The group enjoyed looking at one another through the glass, staggering back in shock and laughter when huge faces loomed. Then the men, quickly learning how to focus the glass, zoomed in on distant rocks, clouds, and ridgelines. When Irving showed them that they could reverse the glass and make things and each other tiny, the men's laughs and exclamations echoed in the small valley.
he used his hands and body language, finally refusing to take the telescope back and pressing it into Mr. Inuk Tikkakrat's hands to let them know that it was a present. The laughter stopped, and they stared at him with serious faces. For a minute, Irving wondered if he had violated some taboo, offended them somehow, but then he had a strong hunch that he had presented them with a problem in protocol. He had given them a wonderful gift, and they'd brought nothing in return. Inuk Tikkakrat conferred with the other hunters, and then turned to Irving and began making unmistakable pantomimes, lifting his hand to his mouth, then rubbing his belly. For a terrible second, Irving thought his interlocutor was asking for food, of which Irving had none. But when he tried to convey this fact, the Eskimo shook his head and repeated the gestures. Irving suddenly realized that they were asking him if he was hungry. Eyes filling with tears from a gust of wind or sheer relief, Irving repeated the gestures and nodded enthusiastically. Inuk Tikkakrat grabbed him by his slop's frozen shoulder and led him back to the sled. What had been their word for this? Thought Irving. Kamatik, he said aloud, remembering it at last. Ee, cried Mr. Tikkakrat approvingly. Kicking the growling dogs aside, he swept back a thick fur atop the sled. Stack upon stack of frozen and fresh meat and fish were piled atop the Kamatik. His host was pointing toward different delicacies. Pointing at the fish, Inuk Tikkakrat said, Ekwaluk, in the slow, patient tones an adult uses with a child. Toward slabs of seal meat and blubber, Natsuk. Toward larger and more solidly frozen slabs of a darker meat, Umingmite. Irving nodded. He was embarrassed that his mouth had suddenly filled with saliva. Not sure if he was just supposed to admire the cachet of food or choose from it, he pointed diffidently at the seal meat. Ee, Mr. Tikkakrat said again. He lifted a strip of soft meat and blubber, reached under his short parka, pulled a very sharp bone knife from his waistband, and cut a strip for Irving and another for himself. He handed the lieutenant his piece before cutting into his own. The old woman standing nearby made a sort of wailing sound. Katunga! She cried. And when none of the men paid any attention to her, she shouted again, Katunga! He made a face toward Irving, the kind one man makes to another when a woman demands something in their presence, and said, Osungavuk! But he cut the old woman a strip of seal blubber and tossed it to her, as one would to a dog. The toothless old crone laughed and began gumming the blubber. Immediately the group gathered around the sled, men with their knives out, and everyone began cutting and eating. Ay palingiagpok, said Mr. Tikkakrat, pointing to the old woman and laughing. The other hunters, old man and boy, everyone except the older man with the headband and pouch, joined in the laughter. Irving smiled broadly, although he had no idea what the joke was. The older man in the headband pointed to Irving and said, Kwavak, swingne, kangunatuliorpok. The lieutenant did not need a translator to know that whatever the man had said, it had not been laudatory or kind. Mr. Tikkakrat and several of the other hunters just shook their heads while eating. Everyone, even the young woman, was using his or her knife the way Lady Silence had in her snow house more than 2 months earlier, cutting the skin, meat, and blubber toward their mouths, so the sharp blades came within a hair's breadth of their greasy lips and tongues. Irving cut his the same way, as best he could, but his knife was duller, and he made a clumsy mess of it. But he did not cut his nose as he had the first time with Silence. The group ate in a companionable silence, interrupted only by polite belches and the occasional fart. The men occasionally drank from some sort of pouch or skin, but Irving had already taken out the bottle he kept close to his body so the water would not freeze.
Kina uvit,
Inuk Tikkakrat said suddenly. He pounded his chest.
Tikkakrat!
Again the young man removed his mitten and showed his two remaining fingers.
Irving,
said the lieutenant, again tapping his own chest.
Evunk,
repeated the Eskimo. Irving smiled over the blubber.
He pointed at his new friend.
Inuk tekakwat, e?
The Eskimo shook his head.
Akra!
The man made a wide sweep with his arms and hands, encompassing all the other Eskimo as well as himself.
Inuk,
he said firmly, holding up his mutilated hand and waggling his two remaining fingers while hiding his thumb. He said again,
Tikkerquat.
Irving interpreted all this to mean that Inuk was not the man's name, but a description of all 10 Eskimo there, perhaps their tribal name or racial name or clan name. He guessed Tikkerquat to be not a last name now, but the entirety of his interlocutor's name, and probably one meaning two fingers.
Tikkerquat,
said Irving, trying to pronounce it properly while still cutting and chewing blubber for himself. The fact that the meat and greasy fat were old, smelly and raw meant almost nothing. It was as if his body craved this fat above all other things.
Tikkerquat,
he said again. There followed, in the midst of the squatting, cutting and chewing, a general introduction. Tikkerquat began both the introductions and the explanations by acting things out to explain the meaning of the name, if the names had a meaning, but then the other men picked up on it and acted out their own names. The moment had a feeling of a joyous child's game.
Taleriktug,
said Tikkerquat slowly, pushing forward the barrel-chested young man next to him. Two fingers grabbed his companion's upper arm and squeezed it, making
aye
noises, then flexing his own muscle and comparing it to the other man's thicker biceps.
Taleriktug,
repeated Irving, wondering if it meant big muscle or strong arm or something similar. The next man, a shorter one, was named Tulukwag. Tikkerquat tugged the man's parka hood back, pointed to his black hair, and made flapping noises with his hand, miming a bird flying.
Tulukwag,
repeated Irving, nodding politely toward the man as he chewed. He wondered if the word meant raven. The fourth man thumped himself on the chest, grunted Amaruk, and threw back his head and howled.
Amaruk,
repeated Irving, and nodded.
Wolf,
he said aloud. The fifth hunter was named Mamarut, and acted out some pantomime involving waving his arms and dancing. Irving repeated the name and nodded, but had no idea what the name might mean. The sixth hunter, a younger man of very serious demeanor, was introduced by Tikkerquat as
Ituksuk.
This man stared at Irving with deep black eyes, and said and acted out nothing. Irving nodded politely and chewed his blubber. The older man with the headband and the pouch was introduced by Tikkerquat as
Asiajuk,
but the man neither blinked nor showed recognition of the introduction. It was obvious he did not like or trust Third Lieutenant John Irving.
A pleasure to meet you, Mr. Asiajuk, said Irving.
Afatkuk,
Tikkerquat said softly, nodding slightly in the direction of the unsmiling older man in the headband.
Some sort of medicine man,
wondered Irving. As long as Asiajuk's hostility remained only on the level of silent suspicion, the lieutenant thought that things would be all right. The old man at the sled was introduced as Kringmuluajuk to the young lieutenant. Tikkerquat pointed to the still snarling dogs, brought his hands together in some sort of diminutive gesture and laughed. Then Irving's laughing interlocutor pointed to the shy boy, who appeared to be about 10 or 11 years old, pointed to his own chest again and said
Irnik,
followed by
Quajoranguak.
Irving guessed that Irnik might mean son or brother. Probably the former, he thought. Or perhaps the boy's name was Irnik and Quajoranguak meant son or brother. The lieutenant nodded respectfully, just as he had with the older hunters. Tikkerquat shoved the old woman forward. Her name appeared to be Nuaja, and Tikkerquat again made a bird-flying motion. Irving repeated the name as best he could. There was a certain glottal sound that the Eskimo made that he could not approximate, and nodded respectfully. He wondered if Nuaja was an Arctic tern, a seagull, or something more exotic. The old woman giggled and stuffed more blubber in her mouth. Tikkerquat put his arm around the young woman, not much more than a girl, really, and said,
Quamanik.
Then the hunter grinned broadly and said,
Amuk!
The girl wriggled in his grasp while smiling, and all the men except the possible medicine man laughed loudly.
Amuk, said Irving, and the laughter rose in volume. Tulukwag and Amaruk spit out blubber. They were laughing so hard.
Quamanik, Amuk,
said Tikkakwat, and made a two-handed, open-fingered grabbing gesture in front of his own chest that was universal. But to make sure he got the point across, the hunter grabbed his wriggling woman, Irving had to think she was his wife, and quickly lifted her short, dark parka top. The girl was naked under the animal skin, and her breasts were indeed very large indeed for a woman so young. John Irving felt himself blush from his blonde hairline down to his chest. He lowered his gaze to the blubber he was still chewing. At that moment, he would have laid 50 quid that Amuk was the Eskimo language equivalent of big tits. The men around him howled with laughter. The Quimic, the wolf-like sled dogs around the wooden kamatik, howled and leapt against their tethers. The old man behind the sled, Kringmuluadjuk, actually fell onto the snow and ice. He was laughing so hard. Suddenly, Amaruk, Wolf, who had been playing with the telescope, pointed to the bare ridge from which Irving had descended into the valley and snapped what sounded like
Takuva'a! Kabluna! Kukiotina!
The group fell silent immediately. The wolfish dogs began barking wildly. Irving stood from where he had been crouching and shielded his eyes from the sun. He did not want to ask for the telescope back. There was the quickest motion of a human form, in greatcoat, silhouetted against the top of the ridge.
Wonderful, thought Irving.
All through the blubber feast and introductions, he'd been trying to decide how to get Tikkakwat and the others to come back to Terra Camp with him. He'd been afraid that he would not be able to communicate well enough with just his hands and motions to persuade the 8 Eskimo males and 2 women and their dogs and sled to make the 3-hour trip back to the coast with him. So he'd been trying to think of a way to get just Tikkakwat to come along with him. It was certain that the lieutenant could not just let these natives hike back to wherever they had come from. Captain Crozier would be at the camp tomorrow, and Irving knew from several conversations with the captain that contact with the local peoples was precisely what the tired and beleaguered captain most hoped might happen.
The northern tribes, what Ross called northern highland tribes, are rarely warlike,
Crozier had told his third lieutenant one night.
If we come across a village of theirs on our way south, they may feed us well enough to get us provisioned properly for the long upstream haul to Great Slave Lake. At the very least, they could show us how to live off the land.
And now Thomas Farr and the others had come looking for him, following his footprints through the snow to this valley. The figure on the ridgeline had gone back over the ridge and out of sight, out of shock at seeing 10 strangers in the valley, or concern that he might frighten them. But Irving had caught a glimpse of the greatcoat blowing in silhouette, and the Welsh wig and comforter, and he knew that one of his problems had been solved. If he could not persuade Tikkakwat and the others to come back with them, and old Asiajuk, the shaman, might be a problem convincing, Irving and a few of his party would stay with the Eskimo here in the valley, convince them to stay there with conversation and other presents from some of the other men's packs, while he sent the fastest seamen running back to the coast to bring Captain Fitzjames and many more men to this place.
I can't let them get away. These Eskimo could be the answer to our problems. They may be our salvation.
Irving felt his heart pounding against his ribs.
It's all right, he said to Tikkakwat and the others, speaking in the calmest and most confident tones he could summon. It's just my friends. A few friends. Good men. They won't harm you. We only have one rifle with us, and we won't bring that down here. It's all right. Just friends of mine whom you will enjoy meeting.
Irving knew that they couldn't understand a word he was saying, but he kept talking, using the same soft, reassuring voice he would have used at his family's stables in Bristol to calm a skittish colt. Several of the hunters had pulled their spears or harpoons from the snow and were holding them casually, but Amaruk, Tulugak, Taleriktuk, Ituksuk, the boy Kwajorangwak, the old man Kringmuluadjuk, and even the scowling shaman, Asiajuk, were looking to Tikkakwat for guidance.
The two women quit chewing blubber and quietly found their place behind the line of men. Tikkakwat looked at Irving. The Eskimo's eyes were suddenly very dark and very alien-looking to the young lieutenant. The man seemed to be waiting for some explanation.
Cut suit, he said softly.
Irving showed open palms in a calming gesture and smiled as easily as he could.
Just friends, he said, matching the softness of Tikkakwat's tone. A few friends.
The lieutenant glanced up at the ridgeline. It was still empty against the blue sky. He was afraid that whoever had come looking for him had been alarmed by the congregation in the valley and might be headed back. Irving was not sure how long he could wait here, how long he could keep Tikkakwat and his people calm before they took flight. He took a deep breath and realized that he would have to go after the man up there, call him back, tell him what had happened, and send him to bring back Farr and the others as quickly as possible. Irving couldn't wait.
Please, stay here, said Irving.
He set his leather valise in the snow near Tikkakwat in an attempt to show that he was coming right back.
Please wait, I shan't be a moment. I won't even get out of your sight. Please, stay.
He realized that he was gesturing with his hands, as if asking the Eskimo to sit, the way he would talk to a dog. Tikkakwat did not sit, nor did he reply, but he remained where he was standing, while Irving backed away slowly.
I'll be right back, called the lieutenant.
He turned and jogged quickly up the steep scree and ice, onto the dark gravel at the top of the ridgeline. Barely able to breathe with the tension, he turned back at the top and looked down. The 10 figures, barking dogs and sled, were exactly where he had left them. Irving waved, made gestures to show that he would be right back, and hurried over the ridge, ready to shout at any retreating sailor. 20 feet down the northeast side of the ridge, Irving saw something that made him stop in his tracks. A tiny man was dancing naked, except for his boots, around a tall heap of discarded clothing on a boulder.
Leprechaun, thought Irving, remembering some of Captain Crozier's tales.
The image made no sense to the third lieutenant. It had been a day of strange sightings. He stepped closer and saw that it was no leprechaun dancing, but rather the Calker's mate. The man was humming some sailor's ditty as he danced and pirouetted. Irving could not help noticing the grub-white paleness of the little man's skin, how his ribs pushed out so visibly, the goosebumps everywhere rising on his flesh, the fact that he was circumcised, and how absurd the pale white buttocks were when he pirouetted. Walking up to him, shaking his head in disbelief, not in the mood to laugh, but his heart still pounding with the excitement of finding Tikkakwat and the others, Irving said,
Mr. Hickey, what on earth do you think you're doing?
The Calker's mate quit pirouetting. He raised one bony finger to his lips, as if to shush the lieutenant. Then he bowed and showed Irving his arse as he bent over his pile of coats and clothing on the boulder.
The man's gone mad, thought Irving. I can't let Tikkakwat and the others see him like this.
He wondered if he could slap some sense into the little man and still use him as a messenger to bring Farr and the others here quickly. Irving had a few sheets of paper and a stub of graphite with which he could write a note, but they were in his valise down in the valley.
See here, Mr. Hickey,
he began sternly. The Calker's mate swung up and around so quickly, with his arm fully extended, that for a second or two Irving thought he was resuming his dance. But there had been a sharp boat knife in that extended hand. Irving felt a sudden sharp pain in his throat. He started to speak again, found that he couldn't, raised both hands to his throat and looked down. Blood was cascading over Irving's hands and down onto his chest, dripping onto his boots. Hickey swung the blade again in a wide, vicious arc. This blow severed the lieutenant's windpipe. He fell to his knees and raised his right arm, pointing at Hickey through vision that had suddenly been narrowed by a dark tunnel. John Irving was too surprised even to feel anger. Hickey took a step closer, still naked, all sharp knees and thin thighs and tendons, crouching now like some pale, bony gnome. But Irving had fallen to his side on the cold gravel, vomited an impossible amount of blood, and was dead before Cornelius Hickey ripped away the lieutenant's clothing and began wielding the knife in earnest.
Chapter 38. Prosia. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. 25 April, 1848. His men collapsed into tents and slept the sleep of the dead as soon as they reached Terror Camp, but Crozier did not sleep at all the night of 24 April. First, he went to a special medical tent that had been erected so that Dr. Goodsir could do the post-mortem and prepare the body for burial. Lieutenant Irving's corpse, white and frozen after its long voyage back to camp on the savage's requisitioned sledge, did not look quite human. Besides the gaping wound on the throat, so deep that it exposed the white vertebrae of his spine from the front and made the head yaw back as if on a loose hinge, the young man had been emasculated and disemboweled. Goodsir was still awake and working on the body when Crozier came into the tent. The surgeon was inspecting several organs removed from the corpse, poking at them with some sharp instrument. He glanced up and gave Crozier a strange, thoughtful, almost guilty look. Neither man said anything for a long moment as the captain stood over the body. Finally, Crozier brushed back a strand of blonde hair that had fallen over John Irving's forehead. The lock had been almost touching Irving's open, clouded, but still staring blue eyes.
"Have his body ready for burial at noon tomorrow," said Crozier.
"Yes, sir."
Crozier went to his tent, where Fitzjames was waiting. When Crozier's steward, the 30-year-old Thomas Jobson, had supervised the loading and transport of the captain's tent to Terror Camp some weeks ago, Crozier had been furious to learn that Jobson had not only had a double-sized tent sewn for the purpose, the captain had anticipated just a regular brown Holland tent, but had also had the men haul an oversized cot and several solid oak and mahogany chairs from the great room, as well as an ornate desk that had belonged to Sir John. Now Crozier was glad for the furniture. He arranged the heavy desk between the tent entrance and the private bunking area, with the two chairs behind the desk and none in front. The lantern hanging from the tall tent's peak harshly illuminated the empty space in front of the desk, while leaving the area for Fitzjames and Crozier in semi-darkness. The space had the feel of a court-martial room. That's exactly what Francis Crozier wanted.
"You should go to bed, Captain Crozier," said Fitzjames.
Crozier looked at the younger captain. He did not look young any longer. Fitzjames looked like a walking corpse, pale to the point of his skin becoming transparent, bearded with whiskers and dried blood from leaking follicles, with hollow cheeks and sunken eyes. Crozier had not looked at himself in a mirror for several days and had avoided the one hanging at the rear of this tent of his, but he hoped to Christ he did not look as bad as the former wunderkind of the Royal Navy, Commander James Fitzjames.
"You need some sleep yourself, James," said Crozier. "I can interrogate these men myself."
Fitzjames shook his head tiredly.
"I questioned them, of course," he said, his voice a dead monotone, "but haven't visited the site or really interrogated them. I knew you would want to."
Crozier nodded.
"I want to be at the site by first light."
"It's about 2 hours' brisk walk to the southwest," said Fitzjames.
Crozier nodded again. Fitzjames pulled his cap off and combed back his long, greasy hair with dirty fingers. They had used the boat stoves that had been transported here to melt water for drinking, and just enough to shave by should an officer want to shave, but there was none left for bathing. Fitzjames smiled.
"Calker's mate Hickey asked if he could sleep until it was his time to report."
"Calker's mate Hickey can fucking well stay awake like the rest of us," said Crozier.
Fitzjames said softly,
"That's more or less what I told him. I put him on guard duty. Cold should keep him awake."
"Or kill him," said Crozier.
His tone suggested that this would not be the worst turn of events. In a loud voice, shouting to Private Daly, who stood guard at the tent door, Crozier said,
"Send in Sergeant Tozer."
Somehow the large, stupid Marine managed to stay beefy, even when all the men were starving on one-third rations. He stood at attention, minus his musket, as Crozier conducted the interrogation.
"What was your impression of today's events, Sergeant?"
"Very pretty, sir."
"Pretty?"
Crozier remembered the condition of 3rd Lieutenant Irving's throat and body as he lay in the post-mortem tent immediately behind Crozier's own tent.
"Aye, sir. The attack, sir. Went off like clockwork. Like clockwork. We came walking down that big hill, sir, muskets and rifles and shotguns lowered as if we had no harsh feelings in the world, sir. And them savages watched us come. We opened fire at less than 20 yards and raised pure holy Cain amongst their motley, god-be-damned ranks, sir. That I can tell you. Raised pure holy Cain."
"Were they in ranks, Sergeant?"
"Well, no, Captain. Not, as you might say, on a Bible, sir. More like standing around like the savages they was, sir."
"And your opening salvos cut them down?"
"Oh, aye, sir. Even the shotguns at that range. It was a sight to behold, sir."
"Like shooting fish in a rain barrel?"
"Aye, sir,"
said Sergeant Tozer, with a huge grin on his red face.
"Did they put up any resistance, Sergeant?"
"Resistance, sir? Not really. Not any you might speak of, sir."
"Yet they were armed with knives and spears and harpoons."
"Oh, aye, sir. A couple of the godless savages threw their harpoons and one got a spear off, but them what flung them was already wounded and he'd done them no good but a little nick in the leg of young Sammy Crisp, who took his shotgun and blew the savage who nicked him straight to hell, sir. Straight to hell."
"Yet two of the Eskimo got away," said Crozier.
Tozer frowned.
"Aye, sir, I apologise about that. They was a lot of confusion, sir, and two of them who went down got up when we were shooting those pox-besotted dogs, sir."
"Why did you shoot their dogs, Sergeant?"
It was Fitzjames who asked this question. Tozer looked surprised.
"Why, they was barking and snarling and lunging at us, Captain. They was more wolves than dogs."
"Did you consider, Sergeant, that they might have been useful to us?" asked Fitzjames.
"Yes, sir, as meat."
Crozier said, "Describe the two Eskimo that got away."
"A little one, Captain. Mr. Farr said that he thought it might have been a woman, or a girl. She had blood on her hood, but obviously she wasn't dead."
"Obviously," Crozier said dryly. "What about the other one who escaped?"
Tozer shrugged.
"A little man with a headband is all I know, Captain. He'd fallen behind the sledge there, and we all thought he was a deader. But he got up and ran with the girl when we was busy shooting the dogs, sir."
"Did you pursue them?"
"Pursue them, sir? Oh, yes, absolutely. We ran after them hard, Captain. And we was reloading and firing as we went, sir. I think I hit that little Eskimo bitch again, but she didn't slow down one whit, sir. They was just too fast for us. But they won't be coming back this way no time soon, sir. We saw to that."
"How about their friends?" Crozier said dryly.
"Pardon, sir?"
Tozer was grinning again.
"Their tribe, village, clan, other hunters and warriors. These people came from somewhere. They haven't been out on the ice all winter. Presumably they'll return to that village, if they're not there already. Did you consider that the other Eskimo hunters, men who kill every day, might take it personally that we killed 8 of their kindred, Sergeant?"
Tozer looked confused.
Crozier said, "You're dismissed, Sergeant. Send in 2nd Lieutenant Hodgson."
Hodgson looked as miserable as Tozer had complacent. The young lieutenant was obviously distraught over the death of his closest friend on the expedition, and sickened by the attack he had ordered after he had come across Irving's reconnaissance group and been led to Irving's body.
"At ease, Lieutenant Hodgson," said Crozier. "Do you need a chair?"
"No, sir."
"Tell us how you came to join up with Lieutenant Irving's group. Your orders from Captain Fitzjames were to go on a hunting expedition south of Terror Camp."
"Yes, Captain, and we did that much of the morning. There was not so much as a rabbit track in the snow along the coast, sir, And we couldn't get out onto the sea ice because of the height of the bergs piled up along the shore ice. So around 10 a.m. we turned inland, thinking maybe there'd be some sign of some caribou or foxes, or muskoxen, or something.
But there wasn't.
No, sir. We came across the tracks of about 10 people wearing soft-soled Eskimo-type boots instead. That and their sledge, and dog tracks.
And you followed those tracks back northwest instead of continuing hunting?
Yes.
Who made that decision, Second Lieutenant Hodgson? You or Sergeant Tozer, who was second in your party?
Me, sir. I was the only officer there. I made that and all the other decisions.
Including the final decision of attacking the Eskimo?
Yes, sir. We spied on them a minute from the ridge where poor John had been murdered and gutted. And, well, you know what they did to him, Captain. The savages looked like they were preparing to leave, heading back to the southwest. That's when we decided to attack them in force.
You had how many weapons, Lieutenant?
Our group had 3 rifles, 2 shotguns, and 2 muskets, sir. Lieutenant Irving's group just had the 1 musket. Oh, and a pistol we fetched from John's, from Lieutenant Irving's greatcoat pocket.
The Eskimo left the weapon in his pocket, asked Crozier. Hodgson paused a moment, as if he had not considered this before.
Yes, sir.
Was there any other sign of theft of his personal possessions?
Yes, sir. Mr. Hickey had reported to us as to how he'd seen the Eskimo rob John, Lieutenant Irving, of his telescope and valise before they killed him up on the ridge, sir. When we got to that ridge, I could see through our own glass that the natives were going through his valise and passing his telescope around down there in the valley, where I guess they'd stopped after murdering and mutilating him.
Were there tracks?
Pardon me, sir?
Tracks of the Eskimo going down from the bare ridge line where you found the lieutenant's body to where the natives were going through his possessions.
Yes, sir, I think so, Captain. I mean, I can remember a thin line of tracks that I thought were just John's at the time, but must have been the rest of theirs as well. They must have gone up and down in a line, sort of, Captain. Mr. Hickey said that they were all around him up on the bare ridge there as they cut his throat and did the other things, sir. He said that it wasn't all of them, not the women and the boy, maybe, but it was 6 or 7 of the heathens. The hunters, sir. The younger men.
And the old man? Asked Crozier. I understand that there was a toothless old man among the bodies when you were done.
Hodgson nodded. He had 1 tooth left, Captain. I can't remember if Mr. Hickey said the old man was part of the group that killed John.
How was it that you first came upon Mr. Farr's group, Lieutenant Irving's reconnaissance party, if you had been following the Eskimos' tracks north, Lieutenant?
Hodgson nodded briskly, as if relieved to be asked a question he could answer with certainty.
We lost the natives' footprints and sledge tracks about 1 mile south of where Lieutenant Irving was attacked, sir. They must have been moving more east then, across the low ridge tops where there was ice, but mostly rocks, sir. You know that frozen gravel. We couldn't find their sledge or dog tracks or footprints anywhere in the valleys, so we continued due north the way they'd been going. We came down off a hill and found Thomas Farr's group, John's reconnaissance party, just finishing their dinner. Mr. Hickey had come back to report on what he'd seen just 1 or 2 earlier, and I guess we frightened Thomas and his men. They thought we were the Eskimo coming for them.
Did you observe anything odd about Mr. Hickey? Asked Crozier.
Odd, sir.
Crozier waited in silence.
Well, continued Hodgson, he was shaking very hard, as if palsied, and his voice was very agitated, almost shrill, and he, well, sir, he was laughing some, giggling like, but all that's to be expected from a man who'd just seen what he'd just seen, isn't it, Captain?
And what did he see, George?
Well, Hodgson looked down to regain his composure. Mr. Hickey had told Captain of the main top Farr, and he repeated to me, that he'd been out to check on Lieutenant Irving and came over a ridge just in time to see these 6 or 7 or 8 Eskimo stealing the lieutenant's belongings and stabbing and mutilating him. Mr. Hickey said, he was still shaking hard, sir, very upset, that he'd seen them cut off John's private parts.
You saw Lieutenant Irving's body just 1 few minutes later, didn't you, Lieutenant?
Aye, sir. It was about a 25-minute walk from where Farr's group had been eating dinner.
But you didn't start shaking uncontrollably after you saw Irving's body, did you, Lieutenant? Shaking for 25 minutes or more?
No, sir, said Hodgson, obviously not understanding the reason for Crozier's question. But I threw up, sir.
And when did you decide to attack the Eskimo group and kill all of them?
Hodgson swallowed audibly. After I spied them from the ridge through my glass, going through John's valise and playing with his telescope, Captain.
As soon as we all took a look, Mr. Farr, Sergeant Tozer and myself, and realized that the Eskimo had turned their sledge around and were getting ready to leave.
And you gave the order to take no prisoners?
Hodgson looked down again.
No, sir, I didn't really think about it one way or the other. I was just so angry.
Crozier said nothing.
I did tell Sergeant Tozer that we had to ask one of the Eskimo about what happened, Captain, the lieutenant continued. So I guess I thought before the action that some would be alive after. I was just so angry.
Who gave the actual order to fire, Lieutenant? You, or Sergeant Tozer, or Mr. Farr, or someone else?
Hodgson blinked several times,
very rapidly.
I don't remember, sir. I'm not sure there was an order given. I just remember that we got to within about 30 yards, perhaps less, and I saw several of the Eskimo men grab their harpoons, or spears, or whatever they were, and then everyone along our line was firing and reloading and firing. And the natives were running, and the women were screaming. The older woman kept screaming like, well, like the banshees you've told us about, Captain. A high, warbling, constant scream. Even after several balls had hit her, she kept up that god-awful screaming. Then Sergeant Tozer walked up and stood over her with John's pistol. And it all happened very fast, Captain. I've never been involved in anything like that.
Nor have I, said Crozier.
Fitzjames said nothing. He'd been the hero of several wild land campaigns during the Opium Wars. His gaze now was downcast and seemed to be turned inward. If mistakes were made, sirs, said Hodgson, I take full responsibility. I was the ranking officer of the two groups with Lieutenant Irving dead. It's all my responsibility, sirs.
Crozier looked at him. The captain could feel the dead flatness of his own gaze. You were the only officer present, Lieutenant Hodgson. For good or ill, it was and is your responsibility. In about 4 hours, I want to lead a party to the site of the murder and shootings. We'll leave by lantern light and follow your sledge tracks back to the place, but I want to be there by the time the sun rises. You and Mr. Farr will be the only men from today's actions that I want along with us. Get some sleep and be fed and ready to go by 6 bells.
Aye, sir.
And send in Calker's mate, Hickey.
Chapter 39. Good, sir. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. 25 April, 1848. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir.
Tuesday, 25 April, 1848. I liked Lieutenant Irving very much. My impression of him was that he was a decent and caring young man. I did not know him well, but through all these hard months, especially during the many weeks that I spent on Terra as well as Erebus, I never once saw the lieutenant shirk a duty or speak harshly to the men, or deal with them or me with anything other than gentleness and professional courtesy. I know that Captain Crozier is especially devastated by the loss. His face was so pale when he came into camp this morning sometime after 2 a.m. that I would have staked my professional reputation on the opinion that it could not grow any paler. But it did, upon his hearing the news. Even his lips became as white as the ice-packed snow we have been staring at now for the better part of 3 years. But however much I liked and respected Lieutenant Irving, I had to perform my professional duties and put all memories of friendly acquaintance aside. I removed the remnants of Lieutenant Irving's clothing. Buttons had been ripped off all layers from his waistcoat to his long underwear, and the caked blood had frozen the clumped fabric into iron-hard wrinkled masses, and had my assistant Henry Lloyd help me in bathing Lieutenant Irving's body. The water, from ice and snow Mr. Diggle's mates melted using some of the coal we brought over from the ships, was precious,
but it was necessary that we honour young Irving this way. I did not, of course, have to make my usual inverted Y incision from hip bones to umbilicus, the base of the upside-down Y running up to the sternum, since Lieutenant Irving's murderers had already done so. I made my usual notes and sketches as I proceeded, my fingers aching from the cold. The cause of death holds no mysteries. The wound to Lieutenant Irving's neck had been caused by at least 2 savage slashes by a non-serrated blade, and he bled to death. I seriously doubt if there is a pint of blood left in the hapless young officer's body. The trachea and larynx have been severed, and there are blade gouges on the exposed cervical vertebrae. His abdominal cavity has been opened by repeated sawing of a short blade through skin, flesh, and connecting tissue, and the majority of his upper and lower intestines have been cut out and removed. Lieutenant Irving's spleen and kidneys have also been slashed and opened by a sharp object or objects. His liver is missing. The lieutenant's penis has been amputated approximately 1 inch above its base and is missing. His scrotum has been cut open along its central axis and the testes cut out. Repeated applications of the blade were required to cut through the scrotal sac, the epididymis, and the tunica vaginalis. It is possible that the assailant's blade was growing dull by this point. While the testes are absent, remnants of the vas deferens and the urethra and major portions of connecting tissue from the base of the penis into the body cavity remain. While there are signs of multiple bruisings on Lieutenant Irving's body, many of them consistent with a diagnosis of growing scurvy, there are no other serious wounds visible anywhere. It is interesting that there are no defensive cuts on his hands, forearms, or palms. It seems apparent that Lieutenant Irving was taken completely by surprise. His assailant or assailants cut his throat before he had the least opportunity to defend himself. They then took some time disemboweling him and removing his private parts through repeated incisions and sawing motions. In preparing the lieutenant's body for burial later today, I sewed up his neck and throat as best I could, and, after setting some non-original but decomposing fibrous substances, a folded sweater from the lieutenant's own pack of personal belongings, in his abdominal cavity, so that the aforementioned cavity would not look so visibly vacant and shrunken under his uniform when viewed by the men, I prepared to sew the abdominal cavity back up as best I could. There was much tissue destroyed or missing. But first I hesitated and decided to do something unusual. I opened Lieutenant Irving's stomach. There was no real post-mortem examinatory reason to do this. There was no doubt of the cause of the young lieutenant's death. There was no reason to check for disease or chronic conditions. We are all suffering from scurvy to one extent or the other, and we are all slowly starving to death. But I opened his stomach anyway. It looked strangely distended, more so than bacterial action and the resulting decomposition would suggest in this extreme cold, and no post-mortem examination would be complete without an inspection of this anomaly. His stomach was full. Very shortly before Lieutenant Irving's death, he had ingested large quantities of seal meat, some seal skin, and much fatty blubber. The digestive process had barely begun working on it. The Eskimo had fed him before they murdered him. Or perhaps Lieutenant Irving had bartered his telescope, valise, and few personal possessions in the valise in exchange for this seal meat and blubber. But that is not possible, since Kolka's mate Hickey reported that he saw the Eskimo murder and rob the lieutenant. Seal meat and fish were on the Eskimo sled that Mr. Farr brought back, using it to transport Lieutenant Irving's body. Farr reported that they had thrown other objects off the sled, baskets, cooking pots of some sort, things lashed above the seal meat and fish, so as to better situate the lieutenant's corpse on the light sled. "We wanted to make Lieutenant Irving as comfortable as possible," was what Sergeant Tozer had said. So the Eskimo must have first offered him their food, allowed him time to eat it, if not digest it, and then repacked their sled before falling upon him with such savagery. To approach someone as a friend and then to murder and mutilate him so, can we believe that there is a race so treacherous and so malevolent and so barbarous? What could have prompted this sudden and violent change of attitude on the part of the natives? Could the lieutenant have said or done something that violated their sacred taboos? Or did they simply want to rob him? Was the brass telescope the reason for Lieutenant Irving's terrible death? There is another possibility, but one so heinous and so unlikely that I hardly wish to record it here. The Eskimo did not kill Lieutenant Irving. But this makes no sense either. Kolka's mate Hickey clearly stated that he saw 6 to 8 of the natives assailing the lieutenant. He saw them steal the lieutenant's valise, telescope, and other possessions, while strangely they did not find his pistol or go through his other pockets. Kolka's mate Hickey told Captain Fitzjames today, I was present during the discussion, that he, Hickey, watched from a distance as the savages disemboweled our friend. Hickey hid and watched as all this went on. It is still pitch dark and very cold, but Captain Crozier is leaving in 20 minutes to take a few men the several miles to the site of the murder and of today's deadly skirmish with the Eskimo. Presumably their bodies are still lying in the valley there. I have just completed stitching Lieutenant Irving. As tired as I am, I have not slept for more than 24 hours. I will have Lloyd finish the dressing of the lieutenant and make final preparations for his burial later today. As Providence would have it, Irving brought his dress uniform in his bag of personal possessions from Terra. He will be dressed in that. I am going now to ask Captain Crozier if I may accompany him, Lieutenant Little, Mr. Farr, and the others to the murder site.
Chapter 40. Pegler. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 40 minutes, 58 seconds west. 25 April, 1848. When the fog shifted, something that looked like an oversized human brain seemed to be rising out of the frozen ground. Grey, convoluted, coiled upon itself, glistening with ice. Harry Pegler realized that he was looking at John Irving's entrails.
"Thus is the sport,"
Thomas Farr said needlessly. Pegler had been somewhat surprised that the captain had ordered him to come along on this trip to the murder site. The captain of the foretop had not been in either party, Irving's or Hodgson's, involved in yesterday's incidents. But then Pegler had looked at the other men chosen to go on this pre-dawn investigatory expedition. First Lieutenant Edward Little, Tom Johnson, Crozier's bosun's mate and old crewman from the South Polar Expedition, Captain of the Maintop Farr, who had been here yesterday, Dr. Goodsir, Lieutenant Le Vicomte from Erebus, First Mate Robert Thomas, and a guard of 4 Marines with weapons, Hopcraft, Healy, and Pilkington, under the command of Corporal Pearson. Harry Pegler hoped he was not flattering himself to think that, for whatever reason, Captain Crozier had chosen people he trusted for this outing. Malcontents and incompetents had been left behind at Terra Camp, the sea lawyer Hickey heading up a detail to dig Lieutenant Irving's grave for this afternoon's burial service. Crozier's party had left camp long before dawn, following the footprints from yesterday and the tracks of the Eskimo sledge that had borne the body to the camp southeast by lantern light. When the tracks disappeared on the stony ridgelines, they were easily found in the snowy vales beyond. The temperature had risen at least 55 degrees during the night, bringing the air up to 0 degrees or higher, and a thick fog had rolled in. Harry Pegler, a veteran of weather on most of the Earth's seas and oceans, had no idea how it could be so foggy when there was no unfrozen liquid water within hundreds and hundreds of miles. Perhaps these were low clouds, skimming across the surface of the pack ice and colliding with this godforsaken island that rose only a few yards above sea level at its highest point. The sunrise, when it came, was no sunrise at all, but only a vague yellow glow in the swirling fog cloud around them, seeming to come from all directions. The dozen men stood in silence at the murder site for a few minutes. There was little to see. John Irving's cap had blown against a nearby boulder and Farr retrieved it. There was frozen blood on the frozen stones, the heap of human guts next to that dark stain, a few tatters of ripped clothing.
Lieutenant Hodgson. Mr. Farr, said Crozier, did you see any sign of the Eskimo up here when Hickey led you to this scene?
Hodgson seemed confused by the question. Farr said,
other than their bloody handiwork, no, sir. We approached the ridgeline on our bellies and peered down into the valley using Mr. Hodgson's glass, and there they were, still fighting over John's telescope and other spoils.
Did you see them fight amongst themselves? Snapped Crozier.
Pegler never remembered seeing his captain, or any captain he had ever served under, look so tired. Crozier's eyes had visibly sunken in their sockets over the past days and weeks. Crozier's voice, always a bass bark of command, was now little more than a croak. It looked as if his eyes were ready to bleed. Pegler knew something about bleeding these days. He hadn't told his friend John Bridgens yet, but he was feeling the scurvy badly. His once proud muscles were atrophying. His flesh was mottled with bruises. He'd lost 2 teeth in the past 10 days. Every time he brushed his remaining teeth, the brush came away red, and every time he squatted to relieve himself, he shat blood.
Did I actually see the Eskimo fighting amongst themselves? Repeated Farr. Not really, sir. They were jostling and laughing, though, and two of the bucks were tugging at John's fine brass telescope.
Crozier nodded.
Let us go down in the valley, gentlemen.
Pegler was shocked by the blood. He'd never seen the sight of a land battle before, not even a small skirmish such as this, and while he had prepared himself to see the dead bodies, he'd not imagined how red the spilled blood would be on the snow.
Someone's been here, said Lieutenant Hodgson.
What do you mean? Asked Crozier.
Some of the bodies have been moved,
said the young lieutenant, pointing to a man, and then to another man, and then to an old woman.
And their outer coats, the fur coats such as Lady Silence wears, and even some of their mittens and boots are gone. So are several of the weapons, harpoons and spears. See, you can see the imprint in the snow where they were lying yesterday. They're gone.
Souvenirs, rasped Crozier. Did our men?
No, sir,
Farr said quickly and firmly.
We threw some baskets and cooking pots and other things off the sled to make room and took that sled up the hill to load Lieutenant Irving's body. We were all together from then until we reached Terra Camp. No one lagged behind.
Some of those pots and baskets have gone missing as well, said Hodgson. There seem to be some newer tracks here, but it's hard to tell since the wind was blowing last night, said Bosun's mate Johnson.
The captain was going from corpse to corpse, rolling them over when they were face down. He seemed to be studying each dead man's face. Pegler noticed that they were not all dead men. One was a boy, one was an old lady, whose open mouth, as if frozen by death into an eternal silent scream, looked like a black pit. There was much blood. One of the natives had received the full force of a shotgun blast at what must have been very short range. Perhaps after he had already been hit by musket or rifle fire, the back of his head was gone. After inspecting each face, as if hoping to find answers there, Crozier stood. The surgeon, good sir, who had also been looking carefully at the dead, said something softly into the captain's ear, pulling down his comforter scarf and the captain's as well, while whispering. Crozier took a step back, looked at good sir as if in surprise, but then nodded. The surgeon went to one knee by a dead Eskimo and removed several surgical instruments from his bag, including one very long, curved and serrated knife that reminded Pegler of the ice saws they used to cut chunks from the iron tanks of frozen water on the hold deck of Terra.
Dr. Goodsir needs to examine several of the savages' stomachs, Crozier said.
Pegler imagined that 9 others besides himself were wondering why. No one asked the question. The squeamish, including 3 of the Marines, looked away as the small surgeon tore open fur or animal skin garments and began sawing on the first corpse's abdomen. The sound of the saw cutting into hard frozen flesh reminded Pegler of someone sawing wood.
Captain, who do you think might have fetched up the weapons and clothing? Asked First Mate Thomas. One of the 2 who got away?
Crozier nodded distractedly.
Or others from their village, although it's hard to imagine a village on this godforsaken island. Perhaps these were part of a larger hunting group camped nearby.
This group had so much food with them, said Lieutenant Le Vicomte. Imagine how much the main hunting party might have with them. We might be able to feed all 105 of us.
Lieutenant Little smiled over his breath-rimed coat collars. Would you like to be the one to walk into their village or larger hunting party and politely ask them for some food or hunting advice? Now? After this? Little gestured toward the sprawled frozen bodies and patches of red on the snow.
I think we have to get away from Terracamp and this island now, said Second Lieutenant Hodgson.
The young man's voice was quavering.
They're going to kill us in our sleep. Look what they did to John.
He stopped, visibly abashed. Pegler studied the lieutenant. Hodgson showed all the signs of starvation and exhaustion that the rest of them did, but not as many signs of scurvy. Pegler wondered if he would become unmanned like this, if and when he saw a spectacle similar to what Hodgson had seen less than 24 hours earlier.
Thomas, Crozier said softly to his bosun's mate, would you be so kind as to go over to that next ridge and see if you can see anything? Specifically, tracks leading away from here. And if so, how many and what kind?
Aye, sir.
The large mate jogged uphill through deep snow and onto the dark gravel ridge. Pegler found himself watching, good sir. The surgeon had cut open the greyish-pink, distended stomach of the first Eskimo man, and then had gone on to the old woman and next the young boy. It was a terrible thing to watch. In each case, good sir, his hands bare, used a smaller surgical instrument to slit the stomach open and lifted out the contents, kneading through the frozen chunks and gobbets as if searching for a prize. Sometimes, good sir snapped the frozen stomach contents into smaller bits with an audible crack. When he was finished with the first three corpses, good sir idly wiped his bare hands in the snow, tugged on his mittens, and whispered in Crozier's ear again.
You can tell everyone, Crozier said loudly. I want everyone to hear this.
The little surgeon licked his cracked and bleeding lips.
This morning I opened Lieutenant Irving's stomach.
Why? Shouted Hodgson. That was one of the few parts of John that the fucking savages did not mutilate. How could you?
Silence,
barked Crozier. Pegler noticed that the captain's old authoritative voice had returned for that command. Crozier nodded to the surgeon.
Please continue, Dr. Goodsir.
Lieutenant Irving had eaten so much seal meat and blubber that he was literally full, said the surgeon. He'd had a larger meal than any of us have had in months. Obviously, it came from the Eskimo's cache on their sledge. I was curious if the Eskimo had eaten with him, if the contents of their stomachs would show they had also eaten seal blubber shortly before they died. With this three, it is obvious they did.
They broke bread with him, ate their meat with him, and then killed him as he was leaving, said First Mate Thomas,
obviously confused by this information. Pegler was also confused. It made no sense, unless these savages were as mercurial and treacherous in their temperament as some natives he had come across in the South Seas during the five-year voyage of the old Beagle. The foretop captain wished that John Bridgens were here to give his opinion on all this.
Gentlemen, said Crozier,
obviously including even the Marines,
I wanted you all to hear this because I may require your knowledge of these facts at some future time, but I don't want anyone else to hear about it. Not until I say that it should be public knowledge, and I may never do so. If any of you tells anyone else, a single soul, your closest chum, if you so much as mumble this in your sleep, I swear to Christ I'll find out who disobeyed my order to silence, and I'll leave that man behind on the ice without so much as an empty pan to shit in. Do I make myself clear, gentlemen?
The other men grunted affirmation. Thomas Johnson returned then, puffing and wheezing his way down the hill. He paused and looked at the silent clump of men as if to ask what was wrong.
What did you see, Mr. Johnson? Crozier asked briskly.
Tracks, Captain, said the bosun's mate,
but old ones, heading southwest. The two who got away yesterday, and whoever came back to the valley to loot the Parkers and weapons and pots and such, must have followed that track as they ran. I saw nothing new.
Thank you, Thomas, said Crozier.
The fog whirled around them.
Somewhere to the east, Pegler heard what sounded like big guns firing in a naval engagement. But he'd heard that many times out here over the past two summers. It was distant thunder, in April, with the temperature still 20 degrees below freezing, at least.
"Gentlemen," said the captain, "we have a burial to attend. Shall we head back?"
On the long trek back, Harry Pegler mulled over what he had seen. The frozen entrails of an officer he liked, the bodies and still bright blood in the snow, the missing Parkers and weapons and tools, Dr. Goodsir's ghoulish examinations, Captain Crozier's odd statement that he might require your knowledge of these facts at some future time, as if he was preparing them to act as jurors at some future court-martial or court of inquiry. Pegler anticipated writing all this down in the commonplace book he had been keeping for so long, and he hoped that he would find the opportunity to talk to John Bridgens after the burial service, before the groups of men from both boats went back to their own tents and mess circles and man-hauling teams. He wanted to hear what his dear, wise Bridgens might have to say about all this.